We're going to look at Judges chapter 7 today, the story of Gideon and the 300. I looked at the schedule of the children's classes, and if I looked at it correctly, okay, good. I didn't want to check because I was afraid that I got it wrong and I wasn't going to change the sermon. So I was just going to go for it and see if I did it right. So all the kids did Gideon and the 300 today. And so every single one of them, you could preach this sermon. We adults, we don't know what we're talking about. And so I'm glad that you guys can double check. And that way, if I make a mistake in the lesson, then all you kids tell me. Now, I did not on purpose hide something wrong, because that's not the way to do things. But if you do hear me say something wrong, make sure you let me know. We're going to look at this story and read through. And so let's just go ahead and get started. Of Gideon and the 300, it's just one of the great Old Testament stories. In Judges chapter 7, I'm going to read verse 1 as well. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the spring at Herod, and the camp of Midian was north of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. And I've got a map. I don't even think it's on that printout because it wouldn't have worked very well, but at the end of the lesson, I'm going to have a map that we can look at. Now I'm going to read verses 2 and 3 because this is really where the interesting part of the story, the first interesting part of the story happens. The Lord said to Gideon, "The people with you are too many for me to give to the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.' Now therefore proclaim to the ears of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead.' Then 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained." I love this line from God. God says there are too many people here, and it's not that they're going to get in each other's way. They're going to get in God's way in a lot of ways, right? There are too many people here because Israel's going to boast. I don't want the Israelites to boast and think, look at how strong and how mighty and how effective we are. I'm going to nip that in the bud, and I'm just going to make it clear that only God gave Gideon the victory, and only God gave the Israelites the victory that day. So God's looking ahead. He knows and he expects, how do you want to word the next part? He knows our failures, he expects our failures, or he knows our temptations and the difficulties that we're going to be facing. I don't know if God's saying, well, I know Dan's going to do this wrong, but he might look at it and say, this is more than Dan can handle, and I'm going to change this up, and I'm going to make it better for Dan. And so we can be annoyed that God can look ahead, or we can think that this is a blessing. He is not going to put the Israelites in a position where they are going to boast and get themselves even farther away from God. He's going to show them just how good he is. I think this is a big idea. God does not want us to think that we are the victory. I think that that's an important thing to remember, right? We are not the victory. We are not the achievement. We are not the end. This building, the number of us who gather here, right? Those are not the goals. None of those things really matter. God is the one. And there needs to be a lot of us. And I'm glad that there's like all these other things that point us to that are great. But God is the point. And so God is making sure that he is helping them and helping us to know that we are not the focus in life. And so then he says, whoever is fearful and trembling, let him hurry home. He even says, hurry away. I think that that line is great. God says, if you're scared, you can go home. What do you think about that? What do you think? In a book about soldiers and fighting for God's people and defending God's people and doing strong and mighty things, especially after Judges chapter 1, be strong and courageous, 3 times in one chapter, be strong and courageous. God here says, if you're afraid, you can go home. That's interesting to me. Is it pessimistic or is it just realistic? I think it's interesting. God knows. And he knows us, and he knows our feelings, and he knows our weaknesses. He's trying to set it up so that they would not be tempted to boast against God. He's letting those who are afraid to go home. Does that mean that fear is or is not a sin? I think that this is an interesting idea to wonder about. But in Exodus 34, when God describes himself to us, he says, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious. Think about those ideas. He is merciful and gracious, and he knows that if I am afraid, he might give me the space to get out. He also might say, I don't care, Dan. I know you're afraid. You still need to do this thing. But in this story, he let the fearful go home. And I think that that's really interesting and something to think about. We are blessed because God knows us. He knows what's going to tempt us. He knows what a trial is going to be. He knows our feelings and our emotions. And one of the reasons that he knows is because Jesus himself came down and was one of us. He was also God the whole time, but he was a person. He can sympathize with our weaknesses. The incarnation of Christ makes this make sense. Somehow the divine became mortal like you and me. And he can know. And he's going to give us some room, and he's going to help us out. But then he makes it a little bit more. So we're going to read now. I'm calling this section the test. I've got three little slides here. I'm going to read 4-8. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people are still too many. Take them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. And anyone of whom I say to you, 'This one shall go with you,' shall go with you. And anyone of whom I say to you, 'This one shall not go with you,' shall not go with you." So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, "Everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set by himself. Likewise, everyone who kneels down to drink." And the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouths, was 300 men, but all the rest of the men knelt down to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and will give the Midianites into your hand, and let all the others go, every man to his home." So the people took provisions in their hands and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel, every man, to his tent, but retained the 300 men, and the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. So God said back in verse 2, this is too many people, 32,000 people. That's a lot of people. This is too many people. You will be tempted to boast that you are awesome stuff. And he says, let them go home if they're scared. So 22,000 go home. Now think about this. You have the option to go home. And you want to go home. But you're like, nope, I'm going to be tough. I'm going to be the brave third. It's actually a little bit less than a third. I am the brave third. And I'm going to do it. And I'm going to be brave. I'm not even going to make fun of them and call them sissies. I understand that fear. I'm going to be brave. And I'm going to do this. And now God says, nope. I wonder what that felt like. You've worked up all this energy of strength and courage to stay. And this is where, when God says, this is still too many, this is where the test shows up. He says, I'm going to test them there, and it's like the test about the water. I don't think that that's really the test. I don't think that the point of this paragraph is that we learn how God wants us to drink water. I think whatever was going to be the smallest number was what God was going to choose, right? I don't think that there's like a more divine way of drinking water. This is a test of hearts. God, you made your point. Verse 2 and 3, God, I'm with you. Let them go home. I believe. I obey. You don't need to make this any more extreme. We already believe in you, God. You made your point. Don't rub it in. I'm trying to be one of the third that's strong enough to do this. I already believe in you, God. I've trusted you enough. What are you doing this for? And all of a sudden, he's turning up the heat. He's making it that much more complicated. I can envision feelings of anger and frustration and exasperation. I did a lot of soul searching to stay here, and now I got to go home. Think of the numbers that went home compared to the 300 that stay, and all the numbers. Or what if you get to be one of the lucky 300? Do you feel like the lucky 300? Like, this is such a complicated pile of ideas. And when I have little quotations that I wrote down in my notes. I'm not saying we need to think this way about God. I think we should not think this way about God, but I can see this is what Dan would think. God, you made your point. You don't have to do this part. You can. We get it. You've taught us a good lesson, God. Don't teach me any more lessons. I understand. I do trust you so much, God. Just do it my way, is what it kind of comes down to. Why do we think that we get to define and put the limits of where trust or obedience is, right? Oh, God, you taught me. You taught me in verses 2 and 3, and you don't have to teach me in verses 4 through 8, so we're just going to ignore what you just said, and I'm going to do what I want to do. You see how the complete breakdown there? I think that this is a really interesting moment. Jesus says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Jesus said this right after Peter's confession. You are the Son of God. And he says it right after he said, I'm going to die. They go, you are the Son of God. Jesus says he's going to die. And then Peter says, no, you're not. Right? We're trying to get back the control. How do we get it into our minds that we have to deny ourselves? And we can pat ourselves on the back for accomplishing verses 2 and 3, but then we start getting restless when God gives us verses 4 through 8. And that's when it gets complicated and frustrating. And I think that that's where the real test is. God says, anyone of whom I say. Anyone of whom I say. Now, God's testing the people here. He's not tempting, but he is testing. And in James 1, you get it in verse 3 and in verse 13, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And then let no one say when he's being tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. Good grief, the word shows up a lot there. And you can look at the Greek definitions. Honestly, both of these words can be translated as a test or a trial. But that second one in verse 13, it often or nearly always has the connotation of ugliness and the twisting in there. And so tempt is the right thing. When you tempt someone to do something, you're testing them. But God isn't going to tempt you. He will give you a challenge. He will give you a test. He won't ever tempt you. And so God gave Gideon and the 300, as well as the guys that had to go home, he gave them a test. And he tried to figure out, what are you going to do? And so what is a testing of our obedience like? What's it going to look like? It's not going to be God tests us by saying, I want you to eat cake. Because that's like, great, that's the kind of God I want. I want you to live in a land flowing with milk and honey. Wow, God, I'll do what I can do. I'll man up and I'll go live a really blessed life. Now, there are tremendous blessings that we get when we live the right way, and we do live in a land filled with milk and honey, and we do have a family, and even if we don't actually have a physical blood family, we absolutely have a family. We have all these blessings. And so those are some of the things that God does absolutely offer, but the testing of the obedience won't be about all the great things. It's going to be about the complicated ideas. It's going to be the fact that when we look at what God's word or law or idea says, we're going to think it's upside down. But it's not upside down. We are, right? If we look at God's law and we think that that's counterintuitive to living, that's because our intuition has been trained according to this world. And we're walking around upside down. And so when Jesus says something like, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are the meek, when Jesus says to turn and offer the other cheek, and we say, but if I do that, people are going to take advantage of me. And Jesus says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit. But if I do that, God, people are going to take advantage of me. And Jesus doesn't change the word. It's going to feel upside down sometimes. It's going to feel counterintuitive, and that's because we've been living on this globe, and we need to get our mind to think in that spiritual way. And so he's going to test us. He says in verse 7, the Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hand and let all the others go, every man to his own home. With the 300, I will save you. There is a very big difference, right, between 10,000 righteous men with the help of God came to a victory, right? Because we might focus on the 10,000 righteous men with the help of God, right? That's the tendency. With the help of God, look at how awesome I am. But if it's just 300, God's got 300 tools. He's just got 300 guys, and he's working them, and it's God who's doing it. And that's the point here. How will you let God teach you this lesson? My recommendation is that you read Judges chapter 7 and you meditate on it. Because the only other way that you're going to learn this is by living through your own 300, right? You may never know what trust is until it's life or death. Until it's the moment where you cannot do it at all unless you trust. And that's really what trust comes down to. There's a lot of things we have to trust God, and we got to be busy, and we got to be active. But there's some things I got to trust God, because there's no busy activity that I can do that can pull me out of this. Now, in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you that isn't common to man. God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. I feel like being one of 300 guys to attack the Midianites, that is beyond my ability to handle. I feel confident in this. I am a little guy, and 300 is a little number. And if I was there, I knew we could not win. And so the only way that 1 Corinthians 10:13 can work is if God's going to be that way of escape. God's going to be the reason it's not more than we can handle. So the point there is, it isn't that God's going to give us easy situations. We're going to find ourselves in terrible situations, and the only reason it can be survivable is because of God. He's not going to let us be tempted beyond our ability. Without God, it'll be beyond my ability. But with Him, I can do it. We need to, as the kind of cheesy phrase it goes, we need to let go and let God. I think that's a little bit cheesy of a phrase. Let go and let God. It seems a little lazy. If you're one of 300 dudes, let go and let God you're doing a lot. But you are still letting God be the victory. God doesn't abandon us, though, right? I mean, this is pretty dire and this is pretty rough. And the fact that I am going to be put in a situation that is impossible for me unless I rely on God, that's uncomfortable. I don't want to deal with that. I have in the past. I'm going to have to in the future. So will you. That's scary. But God doesn't just leave us out there with the old sinners in the hand of an angry God, dangling us over the pit like a spider. That's an old sermon. He doesn't treat us that way. He gives us this next paragraph. We're going to read 9 through 14. That same night, the Lord said to him, "Arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you're afraid to go down and go to the camp, go down to the camp with Purah your servant, and you shall hear what they say. And afterward, your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp." Then he went down with Purah his servant out of the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east lay along the valley like locusts in abundance, and their camels were without number, as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. When Gideon came, behold, a man was telling a dream to his comrade. He said, "Behold, I dreamed a dream. Behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat." And his comrade answered, "This is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp." Can you believe I found a picture of a barley cake falling down a hill? I'm excited about that picture. God doesn't dangle us over the pit. He says, "You got to do it. You have to do it. You're only going to do it if you do it with me. And it's going to feel terrible, and you're going to feel nervous, and you're going to feel scared." And then he stops the story, and he says, "Why don't you go down into the camp and get encouragement?" Like, I kind of feel like if I'm scared, sneaking down into the enemy's camp would make me a little bit more scared. But he goes down, and he gets this encouragement. Now, first off, he says in verse 9, "I have given it into your hand." No, you haven't, God. They're still down there alive. But that's the way God speaks. It's a done deal. It's a foregone conclusion. I have saved you. We still got to do something, right? Absolutely. You got to do the thing. But I've saved you. It reminds me a lot about the way that baptism and salvation is talked about. I've done it. You just need to step up to the plate. And then he says, if you are afraid, God cares. He cares so much. God is in tune with their feelings and their difficulties. Time and time again in this story, have you ever heard God talk so unabashedly about feelings? Go back to the previous chapter, in chapter 6, where he is a fraidy cat. And he says, God, if you do this thing, can you please do this thing to prove yourself to me? And God says, sure. And he does it more than once with him. And he helps him out. God cares about how we feel. Sometimes we need to get over our feelings. We need to man up and do the thing. But God does care. And I think that this is really important for us to remember. Again, he's willing to help. No temptation has overtaken you that isn't common to man. Every person has dealt with your thing or something so similar to it that you can't say, but I'm a special case. Sinners all over the world say that. Well, I have to because of this. It's just different for me. And God says, no, it's not. I know every one of you, and I sent my son down, and he did it too. No temptation has overtaken you that isn't common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. The Lord passed before Moses and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. That's who God is. He cares, and he's merciful, and he knows how you feel, and he's thinking about that. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. If we go to the throne of grace, we will get the mercy and the help. If we are in a time of need and we sit still, we're going to find ourselves in trouble. But if we go to the throne of grace, he's got the doors open. He's ready to welcome us in. He is so excited to help us. And I think we need to remember that. And so you might be in a 300 moment of your life, or you might see on the horizon, there's a 300 coming up. Look for the encouragement that God is offering to you. Number one, it's all over the Bible. Number two, there's a lot of us here who want to help you out too. We need to look for that. Well, let's read now the victory, starting in verse 15. As soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped. And he returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand." And he divided the 300 men into three companies and put trumpets in the hands of all of them and empty jars with torches inside the jars. And he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then blow the trumpets also on every side of all the camp and shout for the Lord and for Gideon." So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch when they had just set the watch. And they blew the trumpets and smashed the jars that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the jars. They held in their left hands the torches and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Every man stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran. They cried out and fled. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army. And the army fled as far as Beth Shittah towards Zerah, as far as the border of Abel-Meholah by Tabith. And the men of Israel were called out from Naphtali and from Asher and from all Manasseh, and they pursued after Midian. Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and capture the waters against them as far as Beth-Barah and also the Jordan." So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they captured the waters as far as Beth Bar and also the Jordan, and they captured the two princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed at the winepress of Zeb, and they pursued Midian as they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon across the Jordan. And if you jump down to chapter 8, verse 5, they keep pursuing. He says, as he's talking to the men of Succoth, please give us, in verse 5, please give us loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted. I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. And they just keep going on. You can read the rest of chapter 9 and see how that all goes. They're completely victorious. Completely and utterly victorious. I think it's really interesting. Remember at the beginning of the story, there are too many. Send them home. And now they're calling out the other tribes to help, and God doesn't stop. Like, the point was made. And everybody needs to jump up and do this work. I just think that that's a really interesting play here. Only God gave them the victory. Now everybody get up and get to work. And I think that that's an important illustration here of responsibility as well as trust in the grace of God. In verse 15, as soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshiped and he returned to the camp. In that order. As soon as he heard it, he worshiped and then he went back. Now, I don't think that he started preaching a sermon, led a few songs, and passed around the collection plate. The word worship here really is mostly connected to bowing down onto the ground flat, right? And so we use the word worship in English to refer to lots of these kinds of activities. But when the blind man, he was no longer blind in John 9, when Jesus comes up and he realizes who he is, he worshiped him. He went down onto the ground in front of Jesus. I think that that's what's going on here. Before he skedaddled back home to do God's job, he worshiped right there, immediately there in the camp. I think that that's really cool. The Lord has given them into your hand, Gideon says. Gideon's repeating that it's a done deal. God already did it. I mean, we got to get up, do what I do, but God gave them into our hand. And so he is taking God's words of assurance and he is speaking them himself. That's what we got to do. We have to trust. Verse 21, I could be reading this wrong. There's some they's and them's, but the way I read it, in verse 21, every man stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran. They cried out and fled. Yeah, I think that's just it. 300 guys stood still for God, and all the rest ran around screaming and crying. I think that this is really interesting. And having done all things to stand firm, stand therefore. In Ephesians chapter 6. The great activity here was standing. Kind of standing alone. I mean, with 299 other guys, but kind of standing alone. They needed to stand, you know, and yell and play the trumpet. They needed to stand. And that's what they did. When we trust and obey, standing still for God, they all run. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. This is one of the most amazing verses in the New Testament. We aren't called to defeat Satan. He already is. It's not my job. And it's pretty presumptuous to think that I could. I resist the devil, and he runs away. Because Jesus went down into the grave and came back with the keys to Hades and death. Jesus is the victory. And so that should be an encouraging thing. All I got to do is stand still. It might just be 300 guys, but all I have to do is stand and resist. It's not about trying to make a big 10,000 or 32,000 army. We need to, however many or however few, stand with the Lord. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade. I'm sure that the alarm and the horns and the light, I'm sure that that's the way that God did it. The camp went nuts because God made it happen. I don't think it's about clever light tricks, although that's how God did it. God made it happen. And then starting in verse 22, all the way to the end of the chapter, we read about their victory. And this is a fun map, and you can kind of see it. And here's the full map, and They went a long way. That's really the whole purpose of this that I think that's interesting. They ran south, they ran all the way to the Jordan, they crossed the Jordan, they go all the way across, and they're going way out to the east. And they're chasing, and they're chasing, and they're chasing. And there's the place names in verse 22, and you could try to pronounce them if you'd like. I gave my go. We have Oreb and Zeb in verse 25. I love the line. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb and Zeb at the winepress of Zeb. And are those named that way because, oh, this is where we killed, this is the rock where we killed Oreb, so we're going to name it after him? Or is it, this was Oreb's mighty rock, and ironically, that's where he died? I don't know which one it is. Both are fun. Both are fun. They continue chasing after Zeba and Zalmunna in the next chapter in verse 5, and they get them. Standing firm, doing what God wants us to do, trusting that this is all we got to do, obeying the laws that look like they're upside down, trusting that they are right side up and we need to make ourselves right side up. That's what we need to do. We need to trust and obey. God is prepared for the difficulties and the temptations that are coming our way. He knows about them. He's planned for them. I don't think that means he's made the temptations, but he's got plans ready for us. He knows what we need, and he's ready to supply for us. He wants us to know, though, that he is the way that we're going to survive. I am not going to survive the temptation because I am strong. I need to get stronger, and I need to overcome my temptations, but I can do them because God is the victory, and he's going to test me. He's going to test me. And I don't know what the test is going to look like, but I got to be ready for that. And when that happens, and it seems like what God wants me to do is a mess and it's upside down, I need to trust that I am skewed and put on God's lenses and recognize, no, God's been right all along. We can see that, you know, the hindsight is 20/20. So the next time it's a mess, trust. God will take care of us. He's happy to encourage us. He's happy to lift us up. He's happy to give us a barley cake running down the hill dream or whatever. He'll give us what we need because he's going to give us the victory. I want to close by looking at Psalm 83. Psalm 83. Psalm 83 is about one of the psalms by Asaph, my favorite collection of psalms. Psalm 83 is one of my favorites by him, and I don't get to do it to close out a lesson very often. Psalm 83 is a psalm about oppression and trial and difficulties. God, where are you? We need your help. We need your help with A, B, C, D. And you helped us with 1, 2, 3, 4. So where are you now? That's what we do with the Bible, right? God, I need help with 1, 2, 3, 4 temptations. I know you helped Gideon in the Bible. Where are you now for me? And that's what this psalm is about. This is about calling on God and building up our trust in him. Psalm 83. Oh God, do not keep silence. Do not hold your peace or be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make an uproar. Those who hate you have raised their heads. They lay crafty plans against your people. They consult together against your treasured ones. They say, come, let us wipe them out as a nation. Let the name of Israel be remembered no more, for they conspire with one accord. Against you do they make a covenant. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebel and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia and the inhabitants of Tyre, Asher also has joined them. They're the strong arm of the children of Lot. Does it feel like that? Is your workplace full of Philistines and Ammonites? Or are you looking at the politics of the day and saying, look at everything they're doing to take us over and ruin my life? It might feel like that. Verse 9, do to them as you did to Midian, as to Sisera and Jabin at the river Kishon, who were destroyed at Endor, who became dung for the ground. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeb, and their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, let us take possession for ourselves of the pastures of God. Oh my God, make them like whirling dust, like chaff before the wind. As fire consumes the forest, as the flame sets the mountains ablaze, so may you pursue them with your tempest and terrify them with your hurricane. Fill their faces with confusion that they may seek your name, O Lord. Let them be put to shame and dismayed forever. Let them perish in disgrace that they may know that you alone, whose name is the Lord, are the most high over all the earth. Asaph needs God. He's surrounded by enemies, and he knows what God's done before. And he makes reference to the victories that Gideon had, right? Those funny names, Oreb and Zeb, Zeba and Zalmunna. And he's saying, do that to our enemies now. And my favorite line in verse 16, and I introduced the word that I'm used to in my translation. The ESV says in verse 16, fill their faces with shame that they may seek your name, O Lord. My translation says, fill their faces with confusion that they may seek your name. This is what it's all about. Bring this on them so that they can know you. And so the gospel is going to add something extra to that, right? God, take care of my enemies so that I can bring my enemies to you. That's an added part to the story of Gideon that we have for us. It's already introduced here in Psalm 83. We need to be strong, and we need to trust, and we need to obey. And when the world is upside down, we got to be right side up. And when the world is hurting us, and it hurts to walk around upside down, we have to stay right side up. And no matter what it is, we need to obey God. God's going to encourage us. God's going to help us. And Psalms like Psalm 83 is something that can really boost your energy on the days when things are tough. And I don't know what you're doing today. I don't know how you're feeling or what's going on with your life. But I know I want to pray for you if you've got pains, physical or emotional or spiritual. I don't know if you need to have your sins washed away in the waters of baptism, which we have a baptistry right here. We are here to help you reach out to God and get the blessings that God is so happy to offer you. If there's anyone here who needs help or prayers, why don't you come forward and let us know as we stand and sing.